album was so genuine. These are real, heartfelt notes of Thanksgiving. I didn't see any traces of the hashtag blessed vibe at all. And to start making gratitude part of my daily routine, one of the first things I do each day is open the Notes app on my phone and list two things I'm grateful for. It's become one long scrolling list by now, and I love going back through it and reminding myself of all the incredible things God's given me or done for me. At the end of a long day, especially if it's been stressful or I'm worried about something, I pull up that list and I scroll through it. Taking the time to think through the blessings in my life changes my whole outlook. It's a fantastic way to start and end the day. So the first key to contentment is gratitude. And the second key grows out of that grateful heart. I'm talking about humility. But what is humility? I believe C.S. Lewis said it best. Humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. I love that quote. Too often, humility gets a bad rap. Many people equate humility with weakness or self-diminishment. That's not what it is at all. You can be humble and still recognize your strengths, talents, and accomplishments. You don't have to beat yourself up to be humble. In fact, that's a pretty unhealthy approach, and it's one of the biggest dangers of comparison living. The more we compare ourselves to others, the less we think about ourselves. That's a dangerous trap we've got to avoid. True humility is just thinking of ourselves less often. It means not trying to make ourselves the star of the show, not flaunting our successes to the world, and not feeding our egos by making a big deal of ourselves. When we get this right, we're on our way to genuine contentment. Then we can celebrate and encourage each other. We can cheer each other on, and we can actually be proud of someone else's success because we aren't threatened by it. That's such a great place to be. And that's the kind of people the world needs more of. Know what you value. One of the biggest stumbling blocks to achieving true contentment, and one of the biggest problems with comparisons, is that we allow other people to define our values. The point of this book is to learn the money habits that will enable you to live the life you want. In order to do that, you've got to know what you value. That's right, what you value. Not what your friends value and not what the culture says you should value. Your values are up to you, but too many people never take the time to figure out what's really important to them. They just go with the flow and chase the life everyone else is chasing without ever stopping to ask what they want for themselves. Every individual, and even every family, is going to have a different set of values. That's what makes us all unique. If everyone were the same, with the same interests, the same jobs, same clothes, and so on, this world would be a seriously boring place to live. But it's not boring, is it? That's because we live in a world of variety. There are endless numbers of things to do, places to go, and experiences to have. I, for one, believe it's time to not only define our personal values, but to rejoice in them as well. Since this is a book about money habits, let's get a little more specific. All of your money decisions will flow out of what's important to you. Your career choices, purchases, investments, college selections for the kids, everything. For example, let's say you value having a job you love, but the career you've chosen pays a relatively small salary. Is it worth less money to love what you're doing? No one else can decide that for you. It's up to you and you alone. Two of my best friends are in that place now. He is a teacher and he loves what he does. She values staying home with her kids. They know that because of these decisions, they will have a limited lifestyle and will have to live financially lean. It's not always easy for them. Living a life where going out to eat, getting her nails done, and going on vacation with friends are rare. However, that's the choice they've made for themselves based on what's important for them, and they're completely happy with the choice they've made, and that's awesome. Another couple we know is making a different choice. He makes an impressive income in sales, but he isn't passionate about what he does. She works outside the home too, but isn't crazy about her job. Neither of them hate what they're doing. They just don't love it. However, they value other things above job satisfaction. They're working to get out of debt because they've decided they want to be a debt-free family. Once they're debt-free, they want to take exciting family trips and move to a better school system for their kids. They dream about early retirement with plenty of cash on hand to do whatever they want. Since they value those things, they've made the decision to stay in their good-paying jobs. The income they earn enables them to focus on the things they really value, and they're happy with that decision. That's awesome, too. Another one of my girlfriends made yet a different choice. She was a missionary in Africa for a couple of years and absolutely loved it. Her lifestyle wasn't anywhere close to what it would be if she had been living and working here in the States. But she didn't care. She was doing what she loved, and she was totally fulfilled in that calling. Just like the others I mentioned, she's living out her values and is perfectly content. I love these stories. And I love how these three families have taken a financial stand based on their personal values. They know that gratitude drives humility, and humility drives contentment. And because of this, they are some of the happiest, most fulfilled people I know. Take back control of your life. Every dollar you spend is a reflection of your values. If that's true, and it is, why on earth would we hand those decisions over to anyone else? And yet, that's exactly what we're doing when we indulge the comparisons. We're handing someone else the steering wheel, and we're taking a back seat in our own lives. It's time to take that control back. If you really want to win with money, it's time to get serious about the inner voices and dissatisfaction you may face when you see someone else's life. You have to take a hard look at yourself and figure out why you're so interested in what someone else is getting or doing. Their life won't change yours. No one else can hand you your values. You have to figure that out for yourself. And once you do, you'll be prepared to arrange your life in the pursuit of those values. I know I started this book with what might be the hardest of all the money habits, but I truly believe this is the critical first step. If you want to get out of debt, live on a budget, communicate well about money, build wealth, spend wisely, and give generously, you've got to first focus on the things you value. That means you've got to quit the comparisons. Habit 2, steer clear of debt. Chapter 3, debt is a dead end. I don't know if I want them to come over. Should we just meet them at a restaurant? This was the question I asked Winston after we made plans for a couple we knew to come over for dinner. I was hesitant and worried, not because of the couple who was coming over for dinner, but because we barely had any furniture in our house. Not very secure of me, huh? When Winston and I moved to Nashville, we were your typical newlyweds, starting out with just a little money to furnish our new home. If you've ever spent time furniture shopping, you might be able to understand my shock when I learned how expensive furniture can be. I had been living as a college student with dorm room furniture for 4 years, so I didn't realize how much quality furniture costs. I wish I could say I played it cool when we went into the furniture store to look, but I didn't. I remember staring blankly at the sales lady as she told me the price of the couch I was looking at on the showroom floor. I may or may not have laughed out loud and said, No, I wasn't asking the price for 5 couches, just one. It was difficult because I was done with the hand-me-down furniture from my college days. I really wanted to step up to nice furniture and not fill our house with a bunch of cheap stuff we would have to replace a year later. Because of that choice, we could only afford to buy a few basic pieces. So, if you walked through our house at that time, you would have seen that it was nearly empty. There was enough for two of us to live comfortable, but that was about it. So the thought of having someone over for dinner freaked me out. I remember being so insecure about it. Most of the friends we had made in Nashville were older than us and more established. They all had cute homes that were filled with nice furniture, beautiful decor, and every kitchen appliance you could think of. From the moment our dinner guests walked in the home, I started explaining why we didn't have a lot of stuff. They kept smiling and laughing and reassuring me that it was fine. Honestly, they didn't care. They just wanted to hang out with us. Most of the expectations you think people have of you simply don't exist. These are expectations you put on yourself. Even so, when the couple left that night, I was still a little embarrassed. That was one of the first times I understood why people go into debt. I remember thinking how easy it would be just to go to the furniture store, open up a credit account, and get all the furniture and decor we wanted. It definitely would have scratched that furniture itch I was having at that moment. What is debt? I grew up in a family where debt was a four-letter word. My parents hated debt, and for good reason. Back before my dad was the debt-hating, credit-card-cutting Dave Ramsey America knows today, he was a young guy in real estate who had several properties and a lot of debt associated with them. By the time he was 26, he had a $1 million net worth. But Dad's entire business was built around about $3 million of debt. One day, the bank called all his loans and he couldn't pay them back. He says today that he was trying to out-earn his stupidity, but that couldn't last forever. Eventually, all that debt crashed down on top of my parents. From renting to owning what I believe. I was born the year they declared bankruptcy. That means I spent my life watching my parents figure out how money works by using common sense and the money principles found in the Bible. Coming out of bankruptcy, Mom and Dad vowed to never go back into debt. It left a scar on their lives and marriage. My parents were determined to raise my sister, brother, and me with the knowledge of how to live debt-free, along with the commitment to actually do it. So I can say that staying debt-free is a choice that Winston and I make on a daily basis. It has always been an absolute in my mind, and I will never cross that line. This was my mindset because of how my parents raised me, sure, but eventually I took it on for myself. You can say I went from renting my parents' strong principles about money to owning those beliefs for myself. My decision to live debt-free is no longer because Mom and Dad told me to, but because it's a choice I have made for my life. Sure, I could go out today and lease a car, get 3 credit cards, and finance a house full of furniture, but I won't. I have lived by this simple money habit. If I don't have the money, I don't buy it. Occasionally, people try to challenge my credibility because of that stand. I guess I understand that, but I certainly don't agree with it. I don't need to be an alcoholic to know drinking too much can harm you. I don't need to do drugs to know that behavior can wreck your life. In the same way, I don't need to be in debt to understand the stress and pain it causes people. I have learned you don't have to make devastating mistakes with your money to learn how to handle it well. Not only do I choose to live a debt-free life, but I really despise debt as well. As in, I hate it. That's partly because of the pain it caused my parents, but it's also because I see the pain it causes so many other people. I never see peace in the eyes of someone who has a wallet full of credit cards, a pile of student loans, and 2 SUV-sized car loans. Instead, I see fear. Because of that, I detest debt with a passion. I was so surprised at myself when I was standing in our barely furnished home and thought for a second how easy it would be to go out and get the furniture we wanted with low monthly payments for the next few years. In that moment, I suddenly understood why debt is so appealing. I had to learn to be secure, happy, and content with what Winston and I had, and that what we could afford to buy with cash. If I didn't, I would have missed out on so much joy because I was so worried about something as shallow as furniture. We didn't go into debt to get the rest of our furniture, but it did take almost 2 years to finally have our house looking like we wanted it to. I remember experiencing such satisfaction after we added our final piece, a dining room table and chairs, which I got on sale, thank you very much. I tell you this story because I want you to know it's possible for you too. It's possible to live the life you want and love that life without using debt. It's possible to finally start living life on your terms and with your money. Defining debt. One of my favorite aspects of my job is meeting people from all walks of life and from all over the country. I especially love talking to people after a speaking event. I love hearing their stories, hearing about the victories and the struggles they have with money. Unfortunately, their stories usually involve debt. One college-age guy approached me and said, "I don't have debt." "Way to go," I told him. "Good for you. Tell me, how are you getting through college without debt?" I thought he'd say something about scholarships and grants that he landed, or that he and his parents started saving for college when he was young, or that he was working two jobs while going to school. Instead, he said, "Well, I do have student loans, but I don't have debt." I politely responded, "Sorry, but that means you do have debt. Student loans are debt." He and I talked for a bit longer, and the fact that his student loans would follow him after college slowly started to sink in. That conversation reminded me that I can't always assume when I talk to people that we're speaking the same language. You can't be debt-free except for student loans. You can't be debt-free except for the car lease. There's no good debt and bad debt. You're either debt-free or you're not. Just so we're clear, let me give you a simple definition of debt. Debt is owing anything to anyone for any reason. It's that simple. Credit cards, debt. Car loan, debt. A student loan, debt. That's all debt. I don't want you to miss this, because if we can't agree on what debt is and what it is not, then the rest of the book will be confusing. In order to live the life you want to live and love it, debt can't be a part of your plan. You might be shaking your head at me right now. You might believe that debt is a tool to get you where you want to go. With it, you can go on vacation, buy the clothes you like, and drive the car you want. And you can do all of that without having the money to pay for it in the moment and without having to wait for a long time to save. In that sense, it's true. Debt allows you to have whatever you want immediately. But you have to realize the long-term implications of choosing to finance your present with your future. Debt steals the very thing that helps you win with money, your income. When you have debt, you don't get to decide what to do with your money. Your lenders decide that for you. You can't choose to take your money and save it, invest it, spend it, or even give it away. You lose the ability to make choices about your money when you have debt. There isn't just a financial toll to having debt. There's an emotional toll as well. When you owe someone money, whether it's the bank, a credit card company, or a family member, it changes the way you live. It changes the reason you go to work. It creates such a burden for you that sometimes it seems hard to breathe. And that while you may be tired and weary of the debt lifestyle, you're not sure how to do it any other way. If you're experiencing those feelings now, keep reading. We'll get there. Debt's deception. Debt always keeps us in the past and prevents us from focusing on our future. After all, it's hard to see beyond the next 30 days when you're worried about how you're going to cover all the household bills. You see, adopting a lifestyle of debt means that you're managing your debt, not your money. This trap is so easy to fall into that many people don't realize they have a problem until they're in over their heads. Debt's broken promises. If there's one thing I've observed about debt, it's this. Debt is full of broken promises. Debt confuses the make-believe world of what we want or what we think we deserve with the truth about what we can actually afford. And when we blur the lines between reality and fantasy, we're in dangerous territory. Proverbs 22:7 says, "The borrower is slave to the lender." You'll never see that reference in any credit card advertisement, payday loan commercial, or student loan document. And honestly, I haven't heard it in many sermons either. But that doesn't make it any less true. Our culture tells us debt is the key that unlocks the door to endless happiness, joy, and satisfaction. Yet nothing could be further from the truth. Debt will always deliver just the opposite. Debt will always leave you feeling stressed, frustrated, and simply wanting more. Most people don't intentionally set out to go thousands or tens of thousands of dollars into debt. They just passively take on more and more debt, never thinking about what they're giving up in the process. Soon, they realize they've handed over the reins of their lives to bills that come every 30 days. They don't even realize how much control debt has over them until they are so far in they can't dig out. Two mindsets that will keep you in debt. How does debt creep into our lives so easily? I believe this has to do with two mindsets that our culture has come to accept as normal. First, and I hear this all the time, is the mindset that some types of debt can be considered good debt and other types are bad debt. Most people believe having a little debt isn't all that bad. And a lot of people believe that some kinds of debt, such as student loans, are actually good. With the student loan crisis on the rise, I think it's pretty obvious that it's done more damage to this generation than it has helped it. This is a lukewarm approach to debt. The mindset of good debt versus bad debt allows people to justify their decision to go into debt. No matter how you slice it, there is no such thing as good debt and bad debt. It's just debt. At the end of the day, you still owe someone something, and those payments limit your options today and tomorrow. The second mindset, and possibly the most infuriating one, is that debt just isn't a big deal. In fact, people who buy into this thinking believe debt can help you get where you want to go. I've talked to far too many people who have been in this debt isn't a big deal mindset for years. They go into debt not really thinking at all about the future, but in the present, they feel like debt is the best solution for whatever they're facing. Their decisions include charging new TVs on credit cards or financing a new car because they want to make a good impression at work. They say things like, "We can totally afford this monthly payment for 5 years." Even things that unexpectedly come up, like a roof repair, get charged because it's the only option. They say, "No big deal, we'll just pay it off quickly." Then the unthinkable happens. They lose their job. They get injured and are unable to work for 6 months. A huge emergency comes up and pushes their credit limit to the extreme. The bonus wasn't quite as big as they expected. By using debt to help them get what they wanted or needed, they bet on the future working out exactly as they planned. Only it didn't. Things happen in life, and we live with a mindset that debt is somehow a good thing or is here to help us succeed in life. We live with the risk of that decision. These are lies. Lies that are wrecking our lives. Change your thinking. If we're going to change our habit around debt, we have to start by changing our thinking. And we can't change our thinking if we're not honest about what we believe and value. Many of us don't recognize the heavy influence of our culture, friends, and family have on our thinking and behavior. The bottom line is, it doesn't matter how much money you make. It matters how much you keep. Debt actually moves you backward in your financial life, enabling you to spend more than you make. Ask yourself this. Would you rather earn $45,000 a year or $450,000 a year? The answer seems obvious until you bring up debt. A person making $45,000 a year who only spends $35,000 will build more wealth over time than the person making $450,000 and spending $475,000. In this situation, the person with 10 times more income is accumulating more and more debt every year, while the other person is slowly building lasting wealth. You can't earn your way out of debt unless you decide that debt is something you want to eliminate from your life once and for all. The slippery slope. Debt never appears as a big, scary monster at first. It slowly creeps into your life one decision at a time. But before you realize what's happening, debt is smothering you and keeping you from living your life on your terms and truly living a life you love. Let's take a look at how that slow crawl into debt happens at such a young age for so many people. Off to a bad start. The world of debt for many people begins at age 18, with teens who are just starting to make adult decisions and who are barely old enough to vote. Our society has decided that you need to wait until you're 21 to buy alcohol, 25 to rent a car, but you can get a credit card and a student loan the day you turn 18. The path of debt often starts on college campuses all across this country. Our culture tells you that you can't be a student without a student loan, and the idea of not going into debt for college is absurd. They want you to believe that if you don't go to college, you'll end up rejected and fighting off poverty, right? So the only way to avoid such a horrible fate is to aggressively apply for as much debt as you need to make college affordable. It doesn't matter how much you take out, because there will be a great job after you graduate that will give you the ability to pay it off easily. At least that's what most guidance counselors, college recruiters, and financial aid advisors tell you. I don't think for a second that these people mean to bring harm to students, though. I just think they've bought into the lie that student loans are a necessary evil for most students to go to college. And I disagree. A series of wrong turns. The pressure on parents is just as fierce. If a student can't get enough loan money for school, then their parents have the option to take out more. This isn't a smart move. But who wants to be the only parent whose child doesn't go to the best college, or any college at all? This is where the comparison game trips us up again. So, with or without your parents' help, you do what any reasonable, logical, and rational person would do. You sign your name on the dotted line, no matter what the dollar amount is attached to that commitment. The reality of paying the loans back seems so far away that it doesn't even feel real. It's so far down the road that your time is better spent focusing on more pressing needs, like what meal plan you should choose. Then, often within the first few weeks of moving onto campus, you sign up for your first credit card. For just a few minutes of your time and a little personal information, you're approved for your very own card. And you get a free t-shirt or pizza as a bonus. Those credit card companies are so generous, aren't they? You don't think it's that big of a deal. You just accept the fact that having a credit card is part of adulthood. Everyone's doing it, right? It can't be all that bad. You decide to combine your newfound freedom at college, paid for with debt, to swipe your way through dinners, weekend parties, new clothes, and road trips. Then the bill comes in the mail, along with the startling reality that the part-time retail job you work in between classes won't cover the minimum payment. But don't worry, one quick call to a different credit card company and you can just move the whole balance onto another card. You end up playing a game with multiple card companies, always using one to pay off the other. Paying the piper. Shortly after graduation, you realize you need a new car to go along with that hard-earned degree you just received. You had your high school car, then you had your college car, now you need your grown-up car. Besides, it'll help you land that high-paying job your college promised you would get by attending their school. Of course, you can't buy a used car. They're not safe. Plus, used cars are junk. New is the only option. You need the $40,000 brand new car to be taken seriously. New cars make the best impression, so that's what you decide to purchase. So you visit another nice group of people who will help you determine the monthly payment you can afford and show you what cars you can buy for that low monthly payment. This often happens before you even know your budget. Once you have that nice new car, you find a special someone, fall in love, and get married. You're married for about 5 minutes before people start telling you that you're throwing your money away renting and that you should buy a house. So you buy a house with practically nothing down because you practically have nothing. Then that house needs a new roof and water heater within a year of you moving in. Suddenly you look up and realize that more than half of your family's income is going to debt payments, and everything seems to be piling up. You don't really understand how you got there. You just know for certain that this is not the life you wanted. And the saddest part is, you have little to show for all that debt you're managing. Facing your mistakes. If this sounds familiar, if this is how your life has gone so far, I don't want you to feel shame or guilt for the choices you've made. I do want you to know that there is a way out. You can live a life without debt, and you can make a habit to avoid it forever. It may seem crazy, but it's possible. Don't get me wrong. I know that not every person is living with an overwhelming amount of debt. But debt has become so socially acceptable that it's easy to think it's just a part of life. Few people in your life will ever challenge you on it either. That's where I come in. And I'm not worried about stepping on other people's toes to talk about it. We're going to take debt on, even if it fights back. We'll start by walking through the common types of debt. Then we'll learn how to steer clear of them from now on. Chapter 4, Dealing with Debt. I still think back on the night Winston and I went out on our first date. When the bill came, he paid for both of our meals. Yes, he is a true gentleman. But he did so with his credit card. Now listen, I'm not that crazy money chick who freaks out when other people's habits are different from mine. I never said anything about it on the date, but given how I grew up, I did find it ironic that my date bought my dinner with a credit card. As time went on and our relationship became more serious, I told him about my feelings towards debt of any kind. I wanted to steer clear of debt in every area of my life and in every way. Thankfully, he agreed, and the credit card was history. So, from that point on in our relationship, we decided together to live without debt, and that even meant saying no to credit cards. You may be thinking, but Rachel, having a credit card doesn't mean you have to go into debt. You can use a credit card wisely. Everybody knows that. Well, here's where you may start to call me extreme. I don't think that there's anything wise about credit cards at all. At the end of the month, you still owe MasterCard money. I am perfectly fine with someone calling me radical when it comes to my stance on debt. I'm okay with being different on this topic. I never want to owe anyone anything. I want to use my money, and that's it. Plain and simple. Because I believe the old saying is true, if you play with snakes, you're going to get bit. To steer clear of debt for life, we have to start thinking differently than what's considered normal in our culture. So let's start with my favorite debt topic, the one I get the most pushback on all the time. That's right. It's time to talk about credit cards. Plastic genies. One of my favorite things about my job is going to New York City to do morning talk shows like Good Morning America, Today, and Fox and Friends. Not too long ago, while I was there doing some interviews, I went to a Broadway show, the musical Aladdin. Anything with singing and dancing is my kind of show. In another life, I'd no doubt be on a stage singing and dancing, either on Broadway or headlining my own world concert tour. But since I can't sing a note, I'll stick with helping people with their money. During the first act, Aladdin finds a lamp, rubs it, and a genie appears. The genie gives Aladdin 3 wishes. He can ask for anything in the world he wants, but he only gets 3 wishes. In that moment, it hit me. The genie's offer is kind of like a credit card. It gives you the chance to buy just about anything you want, just like magic. Except with credit cards, you feel like you get a lot more than 3 wishes. The only thing stopping you is the credit card limit on your card. But if you did rub a magic lamp and a credit card popped out to offer you 3 wishes, what would they be? Based on how people use their credit cards, I have some ideas. Wish 1. I want to have what everyone else has. This isn't surprising. Why? Because credit cards are so thoughtlessly normal. Everyone has at least one, right? How many of your friends don't have credit cards? More than likely none. The credit industry wants nothing more than for you to believe that credit cards are just a way of life, and that choosing not to have one means you're missing out on life. The message becomes, if you want to be like everyone else, you need a credit card. No one uses cash anymore. Just swipe this card. It's so easy and convenient. Plus, you get a lot of perks like cash back and airline miles. These messages sink in over time, slowly convincing people that they need a card not only to fit in, but to also survive in the modern world. So, almost without giving it a second thought, they fill out the application and 1, 2, or 20 cards arrive in the mailbox almost overnight, ready for whatever purchases they can rack up. normal is a trap. If being normal is such a priority, let's take an honest look at what normal really means. The average household has more than $15,000 in credit card debt. The average college graduate leaves school with around $35,000 in student loan debt. The average car loan adds on another $28,000 in debt. You add all that together, and it paints a pretty terrible picture of what's going on with the Joneses. I don't know about you, but it doesn't sound like a life I'd love. In the last chapter, we said that debt makes you a slave, and this is how. The average family in this country has absolutely no say in how a huge portion of their income is spent. They can't use that money to fund retirement, upgrade their home, take amazing family vacations, give it away to a cause they're passionate about, or do anything else because they have to send it out to their creditors every month. Throw in a mortgage, taxes, and the general cost of living, and the normal family has little to no margin in their lives at all. Helping you become normal is not my goal for this book. I don't want you to be like everyone else and do what they're doing with their money. They're throwing it away. They're like a rat in a wheel, running as hard and as fast as they can, but going nowhere. I don't want that to be you. If that's your goal, then I'm afraid you've picked up the wrong book. But if your goal is to take control of your money and live the life you really want to live, then saying goodbye to credit cards and normal thinking is the right direction. The perks aren't worth it. People tell me all the time that the main reason they choose to use a credit card over another form of payment is for all the rewards they get. From cash back to airline miles, credit card companies have done a great job drilling this concept into our minds. I'm going to take my points and fly to Europe for free. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that line. How many reward miles do you think have never been used by frequent flyers? 14 trillion. That's enough miles to fly to Pluto and back 2,000 times. That's how many unused miles people currently have. And so the thinking goes, I'm going to spend more money because the more I put on my card, the more miles I will get for that trip to Europe. That probably isn't going to happen. Thousands of people have the same intentions, but they never actually take that exciting trip. Don't fall into this mindset. Think about all the extra money you're spending just to get those points or airline miles. A credit card isn't an investment. The only thing you can earn with a credit card is a lot of debt, stress, and worry. The interest you're paying out and the stress on your life isn't worth the perks, airline miles, t-shirts, and free pizzas the credit card company uses to hook you. Wish 2. I wish I could pay for emergencies. One of the most common excuses I hear from people signing up for credit cards is, oh, I'll use this for emergencies. These pieces of plastic have really become a false safety net for a lot of people. In fact, credit cards have become the go-to for people in a financial emergency. Car breaks down? Credit card. Home HVAC goes out? Credit card. Suddenly forget that Christmas is this month? Credit card. Okay, that last one isn't really an emergency, but I bet you know people who act like it is. You know what else works great in emergencies? Cash. The only difference is that having cash set aside for emergencies requires a little time and discipline. It can be difficult to build this up, but if you make it a priority, it can happen. Having a solid emergency fund in the bank gives you the confidence to get rid of your credit cards for good. Too many people reach for their plastic when their car breaks down, but you know what that does? It turns a car problem into a money problem. But when you have actual money in the bank just for emergencies, you can simply get the car fixed. No stress, no drama. An emergency fund will be your safety net when emergencies happen. It's hard to get out of debt if you keep going into debt because of emergencies. So putting some money in the bank is the first step. The inevitable is going to happen, so plan for it. The emergency fund will keep you from taking on loans and putting stuff on a credit card. It will also give you peace of mind knowing that you have cash on hand. Here's what I recommend. Begin with the starter emergency fund of $1,000. This will cover smaller emergencies while you're getting out of debt, which we'll talk about a little later. Things like car troubles, small medical emergencies, and smaller house issues fall into this category. And if you dip into your emergency fund, just make sure you build it back up as quickly as possible. Once you're out of debt, you should grow your emergency fund to a full 3 to 6 months of expenses. This is a long-term goal. Ironically, most people who have saved a full emergency fund generally try not to use it because it's their stable source of security. With no debt at that point, it's easier to cash flow little accidents and keep the emergency fund tucked away for the huge problems. This becomes the new normal. When you use debt in the face of a crisis, you're only making things worse. You're treating one problem by creating another. We'll talk a lot more about the emergency fund later. For now, just remember that a credit card makes a terrible emergency fund. Wish number 3. I want to buy things as conveniently as possible. I know many people who use credit cards for literally every purchase they make, all day, every day. From gas to groceries to dinner to a pack of gum, they flip that little piece of plastic onto the counter and spend money without even thinking about it. And they all say basically the same thing. Hey, this is money I'd have to spend anyway. Why not make life easier by putting all my expenses on this one card? I'll pay it off every month. This may be true for some people, but not most. In fact, the average American family who has at least one credit card carries an outstanding balance of $15,762. So the truth is that saying, "I'll pay mine off every month," is wishful thinking. Even if they have the best intentions, something always pops up and keeps them from paying their credit card off every month. Then the bill comes at the end of the month and they realize they don't have enough to cover it. So they make a payment and leave a balance on the card. Repeat that every month and you've got a huge credit card debt sneaking up behind you. The credit card alternative. Honestly, it's hard to argue against the confidence factor of a credit card when you're standing at the cash register. Who wants to be checking out at the grocery store and counting out dimes and nickels to get exact change? It's so much easier to just swipe. I understand. That's why I swipe my debit card. A debit card will do everything a credit card will do except get you into debt. Debit cards often get a bad rap. Many people think they aren't as safe as credit cards, but that simply isn't true. Visa debit cards, for example, have offered the same protection on their branded debit cards as they do their credit cards for years. That's even spelled out on Visa's own website. And new security features are making your debit card even safer. The newer cards that come with a computer chip on the card itself add more layers of protection to your debit transactions, making the store and the bank both liable for fraudulent charges. Rules around these protections are changing as technology changes, so it's something you should check out with your bank. Traveling on debit, not credit. Did you know you can actually travel with just a debit card? I'm surprised by the number of people who don't realize this. It's true. You can even check into a hotel and rent a car. The trade-off is hotels and rental car companies will put a hold on your debit card. The range varies, but it's usually not an astronomical amount. Occasionally, a hotel or rental car place may try to charge you more or give you a hard time for using debit. If you find one of those places, I suggest you keep looking. You never want to base your financial plan on what's best for someone else. Some people freak out and say that they can't afford the hold because they don't have extra money in their checking account. If you don't have a cushion in your checking account when you travel or the ability to pull some from savings, you shouldn't be traveling and staying in a hotel in the first place. That might sound rather harsh, but if a hold on your debit card is going to stress you out financially, you may need to step back and take another look at your travel plans. This is something Winston and I have to keep in mind when we travel. Part of our planning for trips is to remember there might be a hold on our debit card during the trip. We just plan around it. Some would say that this is a major inconvenience, but it's simply a trade-off we are willing to make. I would rather do this type of planning than worry about paying a credit card bill at the end of the month. Cash still exists. Another alternative to a credit card is a little more old school: cold, hard cash. In fact, did you know you actually spend less when you use cash? Why? Because cash is emotional. You feel the transaction when you pay with tangible currency. A study by Carnegie Mellon found that your brain experiences a little emotional pain because you actually understand that you're spending money, money that you've worked hard for. You don't get that same sensation when you swipe a piece of plastic, so you end up spending more on your purchases. A debit card is a little different because you know you're spending your money, but with a credit card, there's little emotion attached to a purchase. Plus, using cash is a great reminder that money is finite. It has limits. When it's gone, it's gone. But if you just go through your day swiping your credit card everywhere you go, it's easy to slip into that magic genie mentality. That's why I think it's a good idea to use cash for certain types of purchases, like for clothes, entertainment, or eating out. It's one of the easiest ways for me to keep track of how much I actually have to spend in those areas. The bottom line. As much as I wish there were a magic genie that could make all our financial dreams come true, that's not reality. The reality is that you live the life you want. But the real magic is in your ability to handle money wisely. That means steering clear of debt, especially credit cards. Say goodbye to student loans. As I walked off the stage after speaking at a conference in Phoenix, a woman was waiting on me. You could see she was in deep thoughts, maybe even a little stressed. After we introduced ourselves, she started opening up. I actually get this a lot. Within 30 seconds of meeting someone, they might tell me their name, how much money they make per year, and how much debt they have. She told me that she met her husband at college, and they had gotten married after graduating 9 years earlier. They both left college with student loan debt, a combined total of $80,000 to be exact. Not long after getting married, she enrolled in graduate school in order to become a college professor. Halfway through her master's program, she got pregnant with their first child. Surprise! To make a long story short, they now have 2 kids, 2 college degrees, half the classes needed to complete her master's program, and tens of thousands of dollars of debt to show for it. She was at this conference because she wanted to find a way to stay home with her kids. The sad reality, though, was that the math just didn't work. She had to keep working just to keep up with her student loan payments. And some of those payments are for a degree she doesn't even have. Now, instead of teaching college-level English, she's working as a receptionist at a dental office. Of course, that's a great job if you love what you're doing, but she doesn't. She'd rather be teaching or staying home with her kids. A dental office wasn't even on her radar when she was racking up all those student loans. And that's exactly what debt does. It steals your options. She doesn't want to be working at all right now, let alone in a job that she's not passionate about. But she has no choice. Breaking up with Sallie Mae. If you have student loans, and statistically speaking, it's pretty likely that you do, please don't take this story as condemnation from me. This is a judgment-free zone, I promise. But I want you to get to a point where you hate your student loans. I want you to get so passionate about paying them off. Excusing your loans by saying, it's no big deal, or everybody has them, keeps you in debt for a long time. In fact, I've talked to people in their 50s who are still paying for their degrees. Sallie Mae has been a part of their lives for so long, they think she's a roommate. If that's you, it's time to kick her out of your house for good. There is some confusion around what to do with your big pile of student loan debt, so let's clear it up. Bankruptcy won't help. The first thing you need to know, which a lot of people don't realize, is that bankruptcy won't free you from student loans. Even if you file for bankruptcy, your student loans will likely be unaffected. Current bankruptcy law exempts education loans unless doing so would cause the consumer undue hardship. But undue hardship isn't clearly defined, so each court decides, meaning there's a good chance you won't be able to get out of your student loans through bankruptcy. You can't depend on a hopeful future income. Many people buy into the assumption that going into debt for any degree is worth it. People think, I'll be able to pay this off when I get a job and earn a great income. Having a master's degree automatically means I will earn more money. Unfortunately, that's not always the case. True, you might earn more money, but you or your spouse might also end up wanting to stay home with the kids or do something else. You never know what will happen in the future, so you don't want to tie up your future by piling on a ton of debt. Graduates often believe that they'll make more money if they get a certain degree or go to a certain school, so they'll go deeply into student loan debt to make it happen. The problem is, that's often not the case. In fact, a recent study from the Pew Research Center found that households headed by a young, college-educated adult without any student loan debt obligations have about 7 times the typical net worth, $67,000, of households headed by a young, college-educated adult with student loan debt is $8,700. 7 times the net worth. Why? It's because these students worked hard, made wise choices, went to schools they could afford, and didn't graduate tens of thousands of dollars in the hole from student loans. Student loan consolidation isn't a magic bullet. I'm not a big fan of debt consolidation in general, but student loan consolidation can make a difference in your overall payoff goal. If you do choose to consolidate your student loans, make sure the new interest rate is lower overall than the interest rates of your current loans. Most of the time, you can only consolidate them once, so watch the rates carefully and try to lock in the lowest rate possible. My only word of caution, if you do consolidate multiple loans into a new single loan at a lower rate, it will seem like a much bigger mountain to climb when you start paying it off. If you keep them separate, you will feel the quick wins as you're paying off your debt, which is extremely motivating. It may make more financial sense to lump them together, but get ready for the emotional toll of looking at one big balance on your statement every month as you work to pay it off. The best way to get rid of student loans. If you do have student loans, my advice is to pay them off quickly. Quickly is the key word here. Don't settle for your minimum payments. Double, triple, or quadruple those payments and get Sallie Mae out of your life once and for all. Treat her like she's an ex-girlfriend. What if your ex moved in with you and started taking money out of your bank account every month? You'd kick her out, right? Do the same with Sallie Mae. And while that may feel overwhelming and impossible right now, just get comfortable with hating your student loan. We'll give you a more comprehensive plan to get out of debt later on. That new car smell. I firmly believe that a car loan is the dumbest type of debt you can ever take on. If you simply look at the math, you are borrowing money and paying interest on something that's going down in value. To be clear, that means you're paying more for something that's worth less the instant you drive it off the lot. And you continue to lose money every month. Mathematically speaking, it's just not a smart idea. The cost of that smell. I once tweeted, the average car payment in America is $492. If you invested that every month for the next 40 years, you would have $5,846,153. Hashtag pay cash. You would have thought I ran over someone's puppy. People came out of the woodwork protesting and yelling at me, in all caps, about how crazy I was to think that you could pay cash for a car. You have no idea what it's like to live in the real world, one person said. I like my Lexus, and I pay $500 a month for it. I would rather have that than a junky car. Thankfully, some people agree with me and tell me their story of paying cash for cars. A friend at work recently told me that she bought a car that she had wanted for years. A beautiful white Mercedes sedan. She had rented one almost 10 years earlier, and that memory stuck with her all this time. When it was time to replace the car she was driving, she went on a hunt to find that very car. Imagine how excited she was to tell me that she found that exact car in great condition for only $6,000. Sure, it had some miles on it, but it looked amazing and was mechanically perfect. So now she's driving a like-new Mercedes that looks and drives as great as any other luxury car you'd see at a stoplight. And she paid cash for it. But it's definitely not the norm in our culture. Most people you talk to think you will always have a car payment. If that is your mindset, if the two cars in your driveway are stealing $1,000 in car payments from your hard-earned money every month, it will be hard for you to win with money. Here come the buts. Every time I talk about cars, I immediately get pushback from people who are doing their best to justify a completely ridiculous car payment. Some of the most common buts I get are, "But it's at zero interest. Isn't that a great deal?" No, it's not, because that new car starts losing money the instant you drive it off the lot. From the first month of ownership, you will owe more on your car than it's worth. 4 years later, you'd still have a year or two of payments left on it, but your car would have lost about 60% or more of its value. Besides, 0% is not the same as cash, and not everyone who falls for the 0% marketing pitch actually qualifies for the deal. But by then, they're already in love with the car of their dreams and are willing to sign anything to drive it home. And of course, some of those deals aren't quite as attractive once you read the fine print. Listen, making money off car loans is their business. You're not outsmarting anyone. "But I just had a baby, so I need a safe car, like a new Tahoe." This is one I hear all the time from people who are having kids. Do babies take up more room? Yes. Do you want your baby to be safe in the car? Yes. But those things don't equal a new Suburban. Safe doesn't mean new. There are plenty of safe, pre-owned cars out there for you to get a good deal on. You can't tell me a 4-year-old Toyota 4Runner isn't safe. I'm talking to myself on this one, by the way. I think the cool new SUVs are gorgeous. But I always have to stop, take a breath, and check my motivations for wanting one. Sometimes, I think I'm more drawn to the car as a status symbol than anything else. Maybe you are too. We can't let our desire to keep up with the Joneses drive our money habits and decisions, though. Remember, the Joneses are broke. Keeping up with broke people who are just trying to look rich is a bad plan. But how am I supposed to buy a car without a car loan?